You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, December 5th, 2007, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Well.
And Evan Bernstein.
Happy Day of the Ninja.
Yes,
all ninja dads.
Your kung fu is lousy.
That's only fair. We had Talk Like a Pirate Day, now we have Ninja Day.
We did, yes.
Did you want to say anything about it being Ninja Day? Is there an explanation behind that? Or is it just Ninja Day?
From the creators of the website, Ninja Burger, a parody website, and they arbitrarily declared back in 2003 that December 5 would be celebrated as Day of the Ninja. On this day, people are encouraged to dress as ninja, engage in ninja-related activities, and spread information on ninja online. So there you go.
I was bummed that nobody at work dressed like a ninja.
Oh, they did. You just didn't see them because they were invisible. Oh.
They were sneaky. Yeah. That
makes sense. So have we had the pirate versus ninja discussion? I'm just curious.
We've touched upon it.
I must have missed that
Let's
one.
Let's see, bird monkey.
Yeah, there are
utility
much more
belts.
Important.
No, pirates, but not pirate versus ninja.
We have to find teacher. Teacher's in trouble.
I just gave you the plot line of every kung fu movie.
Now you spoiled it for everyone, Jay.
You know, though, December 5th is actually a much more important day than Ninja Day. I can't believe you went with that. Today
Well, there were other options, but that's what I went with.
Do you want to know what today is?
Yeah, I
today
really do.
Is Repeal Day, people. December 5th, Repeal Day. Come on. The 21st Amendment was ratified today. That's why I'm having a drink right now.
I see. Oh, I see. Yes.
I see. Repeal.
So back to the ninjas. I think I figured out why is it that when you watch these cheesy ass movies, the guys are always going like, you know, always making like those noises in between their sentences. I figured
that's
it
to
out.
Express yeah. confusion.
No, I figured it out because the people who are interpreting it and trying to fill in the text are bad at it, and as they're still talking or doing stuff, they have to like just throw in like a
filler sound to
fill
make it sync.
Yeah, to sync up the thing. So it's just a weird. Oh God, I love that. If I could spend a day a year like in a kung fu movie where people are just talking to me like that, I would be in heaven.
Hey guys, I checked up further on this. The reason it's December 5 and they chose it as December 5 was because in December 5, 2003, it marked the release of Tom Cruise's film The Last Samurai. Jay, Tom Cruise. Everything comes full circle back to Tom Cruise.
I know. He is Jesus. He's Jesus.
Well, we have an interview coming up later in the show with Lawrence Krauss.
Woo-hoo.
But first, we're going to do some news items. I'm sorry to cut the ninja discussion a little short. The first news item, it concerns presidential candidate Mike Huckabee. He's being interviewed on this week, on Sunday. Actually, I was watching this live, and I couldn't believe the words that were coming out of his mouth. So Huckabee, explaining his surge in the polls, gave us a very, very helpful example. He said, and I quote, "It is aeronautically impossible for the bumblebee to fly. However, the bumblebee, being unaware of these scientific facts, goes ahead and flies anyway."
And right
unaware
there,
of scientific facts.
That don't exist.
That is the single reason to not vote for that man.
Well, right. First off, it's aerodynamics, right, yeah. Steve? Not aeronautics.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, it's not aeronautical. He's not. Bees are not built. They're not constructed
right.
or engineered.
It's only by evolution.
Right. Right. God.
Eva, what now?
Huckabee is one of the three Republican candidates who raised his hand when asked who here does not believe in the theory of evolution. So he's already under the gun a little bit for his scientific illiteracy. You would think that he or his people would, you know, source his scientific statements a little bit more carefully. Now, sure, this is a trivial item, but I do think that how a candidate runs their campaign is indicative of how they're going to run the administration. And Huckabee's running a scientifically illiterate campaign.
To say the least.
This is just one more example. This pales in comparison to the whole not believing in evolution
right,
thing,
right.
but it you know, he should have checked his facts on this.
Well, I agree with you, Steve. It illustrates where his base scientific knowledge is at. I mean, I used to think that particular thing about bumblebees when I was, like 5 or 6.
We all did. And it was only, what, in the early 90s, Steve, that the scientists really actually found out how the bumblebee...
No, it was longer than that. Bob wrote an article about it, and we'll link to it. But the bottom line is, first of all, stating it that way, that science says it's impossible, is ridiculous. Science can't say something that obviously happens is impossible, right? The empirical evidence of bees flying is incompatible with that statement. It would be more, at least reasonable to say that scientists don't understand how bumblebees fly. But that never really was true either. It's not like we were completely at a loss to explain how they can fly. What is true is that we couldn't identify all the sources of lift in the aerodynamics of how bumblebees fly. And over the years, we've identified multiple sources of lift that were not understood before.
Right. I mean, the origin,
scientists are baffled.
I mean, the origin of that misconception probably came from, I think it was a Swiss scientist, I believe, who tried to determine how a bumblebee could fly. And he treated the wings of the bumblebee as a fixed wing craft or the rotors of a helicopter. You can't do that because they're biological. They're not fixed wings. They do special things like rotate on the downstroke and creating vortices. So there's these, like Steve said, there are sources of lift that they had no idea existed many decades ago, which now science has identified, and we can explain it. End of story.
But this myth is in the popular culture. In fact, I encountered it recently when watching the Bee Movie, which was a good kids movie. You know, it was about honeybees, and the opening comment in the movie was that canard about science saying that bees can't fly.
They started the whole movie with it.
They started the movie with it.
Wow.
It's in the family of the 10. You only use 10% of the brain.
Yeah.
It's as ingrained
That's
as
right.
that.
One other little tidbit is that Huckabee said that bumblebees make honey, and they don't. Honeybees make honey. Bumblebees do not make
bumblebees
honey.
Bumblebees make bumbles.
They make bumble.
They make tuna fish.
Bumbles bounce.
Is that where tuna fish comes from?
The next news item I entitled Moonbeams in Arizona.
This one is good.
Yeah, this is a funny little item. A bunch of our listeners sent us this one, so thanks everyone for sending these along. This comes from Three Points, Arizona. A Tuscan-based inventor and businessman, Richard Chapin, and his wife have built a device which is essentially a large mirror designed to collect moonlight. He says, "So much work has focused on the sun, we have just forgotten about the great object that has been here for billions of years and has affected us in all forms of our evolution," said Chapin. So he used his own private money in order to create this.
Over $2 million?
Yeah, a couple of million dollars.
Oh, my gosh.
Nice.
"If it could affect plants and animals, I thought, what could the amplification of that light do?" Well, it could make a lot of light.
Give you a suntan?
Be a moon tan?
A moon tan.
Right. Now, Arizona is, by many accounts, the epicenter of woo and New Age spiritualism in this country. So it's not surprising that the spiritualists are coming out of the woodwork to bathe in the moonlight because they think there's something special about it. You know, it's just light reflected off the moon from the sun. It's sunlight.
You know what they are?
It's reflected
sunlight.
They're
a bunch of lunatics.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that pun.
Thank you. I'll be here all week. Yeah.
Here's one moonlight bather commented, "It feels magnetic."
Yeah.
I'm sure it does.
It's magnetic. It's light that's only 4 seconds older than regular sunlight.
Right. Well, maybe it's polarized or something from reflecting off
right.
the moon.
It definitely has a different, it seems to have a different color because it's affected
a little scattered
one way or another.
Yeah.
I would love to just ask these people a few simple questions, and the first one would be, where's the light coming from? Is the moon generating that light?
Yeah,
no,
right.
They know it. I mean, they know it's reflected light. They just...
Bob, you can't say that anymore.
Yeah,
we
don't know
that.
No, in the article, at least this guy clearly stated that, you know, that it's reflected light. I mean, he's not that off the deep end. But it's really the medical benefits.
Enough to collect the moonlight and bathe in it nude.
Right.
So when he collects it, is he collecting it meaning he's focusing,
yeah, focusing
on a fixed point?
Yeah.
And then people lie in that area where he's focusing
mm-hmm.
it.
They
is
bathe
that what's
in
happening?
It. Yeah, that's right. One bather said, this is another said, This is Eric Carr, who's a hypnotherapist from Tucson. When I got in the moonlight, it was an instant and profound sense of euphoria. It was very peaceful. Now, what this is telling us is that, you know, these people are able to delude themselves into feeling magnetic or feeling euphoric when they're just bathing in light that has no special properties. You know, this is just is evidence to me of the capacity for human self-deception. So that when people make the same kind of statement in response to other treatments, we could know that it doesn't mean anything. This is why anecdotal reports are meaningless, because people like this will bathe in moonlight and think that they're feeling euphoric.
I'm going to start harvesting starlight and telling people to bathe in that.
Right. Oh, that reminds me. The creators call it their interstellar light collector.
Interstellar.
Interstellar.
Huh?
Yeah. From the moon.
How they manage that?
Because they don't realize the moon is in our own solar system. It's not really even interplanetary.
Right.
No.
That's true.
It's within our own system, our own planetary
system.
And
then another sad turn with this is also, I guess some woman drove there. She's a cancer patient.
Mm-hmm.
And
of course, she
drove there to bathe in it. And she said, you feel almost like you're in heaven.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, that's you know, we make fun of things like this, but the risk is that people who are seriously ill, I mean, once you believe in magic or you believe in woo or nonsense, you know, as Randy says, it's a very dangerous thing to believe in nonsense. This is why. Even nonsense that may seem superficially to be incredibly benign, you may have people saying, all right, well, instead of getting my chemotherapy, I think I'm going to bathe in this magic moonlight. You know, that happens, unfortunately.
Well, yeah, and if anyone would think that you're exaggerating there, in the article it does say that it's helping someone's asthma,
mm-hmm.
and that's step one. If it can help asthma, maybe it can help other things.
That's right. The next news item is extremely interesting. The title of this is Chimps Beat Humans in Memory Test. This was a study recently performed by Japanese scientists where they compared chimpanzees to human children and human adults in a test of memory. Now, the article that we link to has a video where you could watch the test occurring live, you know, a videotape of the test occurring live. Essentially, what it is that they flash on a touch computer screen a series of five or six numbers from 1 to 9, and then they flash up there for just a brief interval of time, I think as low as like a tenth of a second to a second, some variable amount of time, but very short amount of time, and then are obscured with just white. The numbers turn into white squares, so you can't see the numbers. And then you have to remember where the numbers were and hit them in sequence from like lowest number to the highest number. It's actually very challenging because you have to, in that moment that you see the number, you have to remember all of their positions and then hit the numbers in sequence. And they showed, you know, children doing the test, and they were doing okay, but they were a little slow, and they made frequent mistakes. Then they showed the chimpanzee doing the test, and they were both fast and accurate. Now, there could have been, I don't know what the selection bias was in the videos that they were showing. I mean, they showed us a kid not doing so well and a chimpanzee doing extremely well. I don't know if those were truly representative or if they were just showing us the best of the chimp trials. But the trials they showed, I mean, there's no question that the chimpanzee is performing the test, that he is hitting those numbers in sequence. I'm assuming that the protocol is as it was described, that, you know, that chimpanzee had never encountered that sequence before, that they didn't just memorize the sequences, that they were actually seeing the numbers and in that interval of time were, you know, like flash memory, remembering exactly where they were. So taken at face value, the results are very interesting, that, you know, the chimps outperformed the humans, the children and the adults. The children actually outperformed a lot of the adults. So the question is, what is this telling us? Now, of course, a lot of the news reports are saying, you know, chimps are smarter than humans, or chimps have better memory than humans.
Yeah, but does that mean kids are smarter than adults?
Yeah, right. So, you know, with these tasks, it's always really complicated interpreting what they mean. Here's an example of one interpretation. Clearly, the chimps were faster than the humans at doing this task. That could be a result of the fact that the human thought processes are more complicated, and that you know, there's more processing going on when we try to do a task like that, which slows us up enough to the point where we can't do it fast enough. We can't perform well on the test. One of the speculations was that human memory is based much more on language. That is one thing that definitely separates us from chimpanzees. I mean, chimpanzees are our closest cousins. They are undoubtedly very intelligent. Their brains are very similar to human brains. But our language area is extremely enlarged and developed beyond chimpanzees. It's possible that over our evolution, after we separated from chimpanzees, that our memory became much more language-based. And this sort of visual number-based task, you know, we're at a disadvantage because our memory is getting more distracted or tied up in language. And chimpanzees are not.
You saw the video, right?
Yeah.
First of all, I think it's amazing that the chimpanzee actually can recognize the numbers and know what order they come in.
Well, they taught the chimpanzees to count to nine before the study, and they only used chimpanzees that already knew how to count to nine. That's what they said.
And if you watch the video, the chimpanzee not only does very well in those two, I think there was two or three samples that they showed,
yeah,
but man, it does it so fast.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think I could even touch the boxes as fast as he touched them, regardless of what order they go in.
It was surprisingly fast. I was very surprised. And what that says to me is that the chimp isn't thinking about it very much. You know, that it's almost like, it's going in and it's going out without really being processed very much. You know what I mean?
Well, Steve, what about the role of eidetic memory in this process? Some adults have eidetic memory. It's basically a photographic memory. Mm-hmm. Your memory is just unbelievably accurate. And apparently I've come across in this article about the chimps and other articles that some kids have eidetic memory, which then slowly fades as they grow up. They grow out of it. And some kids, and that would explain why some kids actually did better than adults, is that when they see this flash, even if it's very brief, they can remember this complex pattern.
Yeah.
It's like they could still see it, even though it's not in front of their eyes. It's like they could almost still see it.
Right.
You know, maybe in a sense these chimps have some form of eidetic memory that they're applying to this, and that's why, and that would explain why they're really not even thinking about it, because it's still kind of, they could still almost kind of see it and then just easily bam bam bam.
Yeah, I think it's something like that. I think that their performance on this task is very straightforward. As you say, it's like it's just a visual memory that they don't have to really think about it or process it, because they were doing it very, very quickly. The other point, actually, the article didn't make this point, and the researchers didn't make this point, but it occurred to me that just to get out of this hierarchical thinking in evolution, you know, humans are not in any way above chimpanzees in any kind of, you know, evolutionary chain or hierarchy. Chimpanzees and humans share a common ancestor, but they're just as, you know, quote-unquote evolved as we were. And they underwent, you know, 5 or whatever million years of evolution after they split from us too. And, you know, they may have, under their own selective pressures, evolved this kind of very good visual memory after they split from humans.
Yeah, that's actually very interesting. I wouldn't have thought of that.
To state the necessary caveats, animal research is always difficult because, you know, there's the clever Hans effect. You have to make sure that there was nothing else going on in this protocol that could have contaminated these results. You know, the details of the methods really have to be pored over, and I'd like to see it replicated. But again, that's what I say, taken at face value, assuming there's no error in the methods, then the results are quite impressive. One more news item before we go on to some emails. A study recently published looked at YouTube videos dealing with vaccination. This was published by researchers out of the University of Toronto. And what they found is that half of the videos dealing with vaccinations on YouTube were anti-vaccination, that they were spreading misinformation and anti-vaccinationist propaganda. Dr. Wilson and Dr. Keelan analyzed 153 videos. And they found actually that 45% contained messages that contradict the 2006 Canadian Immunization Guide, which is very similar to the United States Public Health Service guides as well. They also found that the anti-vaccination videos had far more hits than the ones that were in line with the science-based recommendations. Which makes sense. You know, if you have a fear-mongering, sensational video about how vaccines are killing your kids, that's going to have more of a public appeal than one that is, you know, more evidence-based and doesn't say anything particularly shocking or surprising.
That's an interesting metric. I wonder what other information that they can pull out of just people's viewing habits like that.
Obviously, the internet is a huge source of information and an increasingly a source of information for the public, and we do have to pay attention to what information is on there and what influence it's having. Well, let's move on to your questions and emails. The first one comes from Richard Percival from the USA, and he writes, "A friend is getting adult stem cells to help with his elderly father. He is desperate, so I can understand his willingness to try anything. I included the website listing below. I am almost certain it is a scam. Someone is trying to replace supplements with these stem cell pills. Not sure if it is any better. Just curious if there are any papers or sites that might provide a more educated look at this stuff. Are there stem cell vendors like this popping up all over the country?" And then he provides a link. Yeah, he links to the website, a website called Stem Cells for Wellness. And this actually is not, this is a supplement that is actually not stem cells. It is a supplement designed to, or, you know, claimed to, I should say, to support your native stem cells. So this is just another supplement making pseudoscientific claims, capitalizing on the latest buzzword, stem cells, and making completely unproven claims. Again, within the laws of the United States, you can make what are so-called structure function claims. You can make claims that do not reference a specific disease. Just say this is supporting some function in the body. You know, boosting the immune system has been a favorite of supplements in recent years, and now we're seeing a new one because, you know, immune system was the buzzword. And now stem cells are buzzwords. Now this is supporting your native stem cells or stem cell physiology.
Supporting your existing stem cells? Is that what they're talking about?
That's right.
About?
Yeah, that we have stem cells in our bone marrow, for example, and, you know, throughout our body. We have our own. There are cells that are relatively undifferentiated, adult stem cells. And they are responsible for some repair functions and, you know, replenishing your blood and things like that. They do actually perform a vital role in the body, just like the immune system does. But again, this is just putting some crap in a pill and saying and surrounding it with scientific sounding claims meant to just have the word stem cell research on the top in red capital letters, you know, on the top of the website so that people think they're getting stem cells.
Yeah.
You know, Richard, it seems like to me that Richard thought that these were adult stem cells that they were getting rather than a supplement meant to support stem cells. So that's fine. They'll trade on that. But actually, to answer his question, there are stem cell vendors popping up, but not in the United States. They're mainly in offshore clinics. And I've spoken about this before. For example, clinics in China claiming to treat ALS and spinal cord disorder with stem cells. There's also, you can go to Mexico and get stem cells injected into your butt if you'd like, or, you know, other offshore clinics. None of it works. None of it is scientific. It's all just exploitive, just, you know, making money off of desperate sick people with the latest, you know, scientific fad. The next email comes from Channel Locks. That's his forum name. I actually pulled this one off of the Skeptics Guide forums. And they write, "Someone recently posted this on another forum I frequent. I'm curious to know if anyone else here has read it and what you think about it." And he gives a link to cosmicfingerprints.com. "It was difficult to read some of it because the entire time I was reading, I envisioned this guy pointing a finger and screaming at me. Also, I searched before I posted it. I'm sorry if this topic has been covered before." It hasn't. It's actually an interesting website. This guy's obviously a crank. And the gist of the website is that he's saying that information theory proves the existence of God, that it proves evolution could not have happened. And his line of argument is that only intelligence can create a code of information, that DNA is a code of information, therefore intelligent design, you know, created DNA and therefore life, and evolution could not have. That's his argument. And then he's challenging the skeptical community and the atheist community to prove him wrong. He posted his thesis, you know, on an atheist forum, and that's the forum that Channel Locks was referring to. And what is hilarious is that the very first post on that thread completely demolished his whole argument, and the guy never even noticed that right out of the gate, done, demolished. And then he just, you know, engaged in just some irrelevant straw man arguments with other people on the forum. But meanwhile, he was already done and didn't even know it. The basic problem with what he's saying is that, you know, first of all, logical fallacy he's committing is his unstated major premise is that if one thing in nature involves coded information, then there must be other things in nature that involve coded information. But there's no reason that premise should be true. Perhaps life or processes like life are the only things that can naturally develop coded information, like DNA. It's very common for intelligent design proponents, or as more and more people are saying these days, see design proponentists.
I love that.
the typo that came out in the Dover trial, the typo of pandas and people, where they did a copy and paste. They changed the word creationists with design proponents, and they didn't select the whole word, so it came out see design proponentists. Hilarious. It's like a smoking gun of creationism is intelligent design.
Right.
But anyway, a very common argument, and Dembski puts forth this argument, others in the ID camp put forth this argument, is that information theory proves that evolution is impossible, that evolution cannot increase information over time. Dembski then tried to, you know, avoid some criticism by calling it specified information. But he doesn't ever really define what he means by information in any meaningful or operational way. He's just using the word information loosely. And in fact, he switches the definition around as needed in order to construct his fallacious arguments. But, and here's, in a nutshell, here's the argument. Mutations cannot increase the specificity of information. It only, because mutations are random, it can only degrade the information. And natural selection cannot add information. It can only take information away. That latter premise is actually false. But even if they were true, it still is irrelevant. And the example I'd like to give is that is like saying that cars can't possibly work because the steering column doesn't propel the car and the engine doesn't steer the car. Well, okay. But the steering column could steer the car and the engine could propel the car. You know, mutations can increase the amount of information, and then evolution can make that information non-random, right, by giving it specificity. Natural selection is not a random process.
I'm sorry, it also shows that he clearly has absolutely no idea about the processes of evolution.
No.
He just doesn't get it.
They don't get it. The ID guys,
they don't want to get it.
Yeah. But that's, again, they're using, just like the paranormal crowd likes to invoke quantum mechanics, and alternative medicine cranks like to, you know, invoke the immune system and now stem cells, things that are on the cutting edge of science that the public doesn't understand well. Now ID is invoking information theory. They clearly don't understand information theory. You know, the public at large doesn't understand information theory. Really, unless you're a mathematician who studies information theory, you don't understand information theory. So it's easy for them to exploit the general ignorance about this term, and then to throw out a scientific-sounding term that could superficially seem to support their statement. And again, it's not about understanding information. It's not about understanding evolution. It's all about throwing up a smokescreen to provide cover for a religious belief. That's what it's about. And it actually succeeds within that community in doing that. Before we go on to our interview, we're going to do a quick name that logical fallacy. The name of the logical fallacy for this week is this. This one comes from Brandon Putz from Edwardsville, Illinois, and he writes, "We humans must constantly be aware of the fallacy that correlation does not mean causation. Although I understand this fallacy, I'm not sure how the burden of proof is met. How do scientists prove causation? What burden of proof must one meet to satisfy skeptics and scientists?" It's actually a very good question. In my experience, the correlation does not equal causation logical fallacy. Well, of course it is. A valid logical fallacy is much abused. And often the opposite fallacy is committed. People assume that causation is ruled out, correlation does not necessarily mean causation, but it can. And I think sometimes people forget that correlation can be due to causation, but that's only one possible cause. That's only one possible causal relationship. So, for example, we say that A correlates with B. That could mean that A causes B. It could also mean that B causes A. Or it could mean that C causes both A and B. Or it could mean that it's just a random noise, that that they don't truly correlate, that it's just a chance correlation, that there is no causal relationship between the two. And since lots of things are happening, there's lots of chance, non-meaningful correlations going on all the time. I think one of the fun ones from history is correlating sunspots with miniskirt lengths. You know, that actually correlated quite nicely. Or the one that demonstrates the C causes A and B option is that church attendance correlates with drunkenness, public drunkenness. It's actually both correlate with population sizes, but neither causes the other. But the question is, well, maybe the correlation does result from A causing B. How do we know? And to give a medical example, how do we know that cigarette smoking causes cancer?
Isn't it all about the experiment? All the different types of experiments you would have to do, controlling for various factors, until after the series of experiments, you'd say, well, our confidence level that A causes B is now at 99%. So now I think we can confidently say that A causes B.
Well, I think you're talking about just the statistical significance, or how sure can we be that the correlation is real. But I think that you have to go beyond that just one correlation, and you have to do what I call triangulation. You have to see that the correlation shows up in multiple different ways, in every way that you would predict it should, given your causal hypothesis. So if we look back at smoking and cancer, the tobacco industry has said for years, well, this is just a correlation, and you can't assume causation from correlation. Yeah, so smoking correlates with cancer, but you can't. That doesn't prove that it causes it. Maybe there's this factor X that causes both smoking and cancer. In fact, early on in like the 40s and 50s, they actually said that cancer causes smoking. Can you believe that? Because they said that cancer is irritating and makes you anxious, and you smoke to relax.
Oh, my God.
Can you imagine? So how do we know that smoking causes cancer? You can't do the empirical study of a randomized prospective trial. There you're actually controlling variables and looking at direct cause and effect, not just correlation. You can't do that because you can't randomly assign people to smoke, right? It's an unethical study and nobody would do it anyway. What you can do, though, is say, well, okay, if we take the smoking causes cancer hypothesis to explain the correlation of smoking with certain kinds of lung cancer, then that means that the longer you smoke, the greater the correlation. And if you quit smoking, the correlation should go away. And if you smoke unfiltered cigarettes, the correlation should be stronger than if you smoke filtered cigarettes, etc. You ask all of these sub-correlation questions that flow from your causal hypothesis. And if they all line up in the same direction, they triangulate on that one causal relationship, then that supports that hypothesis, because it made predictions that then later came true. So that's how we do it. And that's how we know that smoking causes cancer, because every way you ask the question, the correlation holds up to that particular hypothesis.
Steve, I've got a question for you.
Yeah.
Many times we've said on the show, and you know, we've read and heard scientists say things like, you know, you have to be able to falsify something mm-hmm. in order to do a true scientific study. And then, now put that aside for a second, and we also say things like, they'll do a study, and then they'll pick the result after the study has been completed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's the relationship between those two, and why is the latter one wrong?
Well, because the way we know test hypotheses in science is for them to make predictions and then to see if those predictions come true. Theories in science are tested primarily by how well they make predictions. If you're retrodicting, if you're just picking a correlation after the fact, that could seem compelling, but if it wasn't an actual prediction, it actually means nothing, because random correlations are going to occur very frequently. In fact, random correlations occur much more frequently than humans naively assume. Our gut feeling about how likely something is completely misleading. That's why people believe in astrology, you know, because they see correlations and they think those correlations mean something. And they miss the fact that, well, astrology actually can't successfully predict anything. You can only see these correlations retrospectively. So retrospective data is always weak for that reason. It really can only be used to generate hypotheses. It's not, however, actually testing those hypotheses. Only predicting the future does that. Well, let's go on to our interview. Joining us now is Dr. Lawrence Krauss. Dr. Krauss, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
It's nice to be here.
And Dr. Krauss is the director of the Center for Education and Research in Cosmology and Astrophysics at the Case Western Reserve University. He is the author of many popular science books, including Fear of Physics, The Physics of Star Trek, Beyond Star Trek, Adam, An Odyssey from the Big Bang to Life on Earth and Beyond. And this is your most recent book, Hiding in the Mirror, The Mysterious Allure of Extra Dimensions, From Plato to String Theory and Beyond. Dr. Krauss is also the author of many popular articles and has received many awards for teaching the public science. And since that is also the mission of our humble podcast, that is definitely something we share. We greatly appreciate those scientists like yourself who have decided to spend a lot of their time popularizing what they do to the public and improving the public understanding of science. So let me just start by asking you, was there some point in your career where you decided that you really wanted to invest a lot of your time and effort teaching the public science?
Well, I wouldn't say it was a conscious decision in that sense. It's more that when I was thinking about becoming a scientist when I was younger, one of the things that affected me was reading books by scientists. And in some sense, I guess I wanted to return the favor. And for me, still, one of the greatest joys is when a young person, sometimes not so young anymore, comes up to me and says, one of your books caused me to be a scientist, and I think that's great. But, I think it's sort of evolved because I've always been interested in writing, and I basically also, it's one way I vent when I get upset. So even when I was a graduate student, I would try and write op-ed pieces. None of them would ever be published, of course.
Yeah.
But I'd submit them. And I wrote some other popular things. And then slowly, I guess it's just a matter of sometimes, as I say, when I get upset now, I write op-eds. But when I was at Harvard University as a postdoc, and there afterwards, I started to write some Scientific American articles, and there was a great deal of interest in. Actually, when I was at Harvard, a colleague of mine named Steve Weinberg, who's a Nobel Prize-winning physicist, had written a popular book called The First 3 Minutes about cosmology. And his publisher came up to talk to him, and then for some reason Steve and I were talking, and the publisher and I started talking, and he basically convinced me to sign on and write a book. It ended up not being my first book. I ended up putting it aside for another one. And it just sort of built up. And I guess what happens is also, as I became more successful at it, I kind of felt a responsibility. I think it's very important. My science to me is also very important, but I kind of feel like a fraud if I'm not doing science, but I also kind of feel like a fraud if I'm only doing science and not trying to explain what I do. And also, for obvious reasons, and we'll probably talk about it, for me, science has a great impact on society, and to see abuses of science is something I think it's very important that scientists like me speak out against. So it sort of grew, and I now feel, of course, not only is it probably one of the more important things I do, but I feel a responsibility because I have a relatively high profile, and I can, in principle, have a soapbox or make an impact, and I think it's important to do that whenever I can.
One of the things I admire about you, and I think that even those scientists who have decided that they're going to try to popularize their work, I think don't, as you say, defend science from nonsense or think or write about the sociological effects of science. But you definitely have taken that on, for example, like the teaching of evolution versus creationism in public schools.
Yeah, well, again, it wasn't something I planned to do. It just, first of all, I get upset about it. And secondly, sometimes it seems to me there's a gap. I actually got involved in that largely because I was kind of surprised that biologists weren't speaking out.
Yeah.
And moreover, I guess I saw that as not so much an attack on evolution as an attack on science. And I still do. I think that's really what it's all about. And that's why it was appropriate for me as a physicist and someone who tries to defend science to speak out. But I think it's just a matter of my constitution. It's just the way I am. If there are issues I get concerned about, this is one way I can impact on them.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the scientific community needs to do a lot more of that.
Well, I agree. I mean, I think we've been very lax and pretty complacent over the years, and that's part of the problem. It didn't seem like a threat to many scientists, and they let it go. But I think now more than ever in our society, all of the challenges that face our political system, in fact, our government, are basically have a science and technical component. In fact, actually, as we speak, just tonight, I just have a piece coming out of the Wall Street Journal where we're proposing and making a public call for presidential debate on science and technology issues, one of the presidential debates. I put together, we have a group, and we've gotten signatories from about 10 Nobel laureates and presidents of universities and heads of some scientific societies. So I just wrote a piece about that, and I think it may actually happen. And I think that would be a great way to try and raise...
Oh. What a great idea. What a great idea.
Yeah, we've actually talked about that ourselves, that is something that is definitely needed.
I don't think Huckabee would be invited, though, would he?
Well, first of all, it'll be for the actual candidates, and so I'm not so clear that Huckabee would be invited, but he certainly would be a lightning rod. In fact, in my piece for the Wall Street Journal, I actually referred to him as an example of what we need to do and what we need to overcome. Because, you know, the strange thing is when Huckabee said what he said, for example, just to pick on him, when he talked about not believing in evolution, that was one thing. But then in the next debate, he said, well, I don't see why this is an important issue. I'm running for president of the United States, not an eighth grade science teacher. And that was an astounding statement to me, but what concerned me more is in polls that were done by the American public after that, most people agreed with him.
Yeah.
They didn't see the connection that somehow the issues that the President of the United States is going to have to deal with are scientific and technical ones, and someone who has no literacy is going to have a difficult time following, much less leading. And that's why I like this idea of a debate, not just because it will expose or cause the candidates to think about these things, but it will raise the level of discourse in the country on science issues, I hope. So we'll see. In any case, it's an exciting possibility.
Yeah, and definitely a step in the right direction. I absolutely agree. I mean, I think we're seeing what the effects of having a scientifically illiterate executive, branch of our government is doing, over the last 7 years, right?
Oh, and not. I think not just necessarily scientifically illiterate, but in certain cases, actively antagonistic towards science in terms of censoring the results of scientific reports by government scientists and misrepresenting the results and stacking committees with people who aren't appropriate. I mean, as you probably know, I was one of a group of 60 scientists about 3 years ago who wrote to the White House. Again, there was a group of Nobel laureates, etc., and it was a fairly high-profile letter and complaining about scientific integrity in government. And it had a little bit of an impact, but clearly not very much because a lot of those abuses have continued. And I think that's why it's really especially important right now. And as you probably know, the president's science advisor, who not only has been, in my opinion, an apologist for this administration, or the abuses of science in this administration, but more importantly, he hasn't had much power. That position was degraded or reduced under this president. So it's not he's not advisor to the president. Mm-hmm. And we hope, for example, the next president will change things back to where there is an official presidential science advisor. Mm-hmm. That's got to be important. And for the listeners, if they're interested in this debate thing, that they'll be able to go to there are a bunch of sites, but they should Google science debate, all one word, science debate 2008. And they'll be able to find it, okay?
Turning to some of your books for a moment, it seems to me that your popularity really took off with the book The Physics of Star Trek.
Yeah, it's true.
Is that true? And also reading your website and of course, the book, it seems to me that you're a real Star Trek fan. But that's probably not a stretch.
Yeah, well, it'd be hard not to be at this point, yes. Yeah. As I like to say, Star Trek's been very, very good to me. Yeah, I enjoyed watching Star Trek when I was growing up. I never dressed up or anything like that.
Yeah.
And in fact, I had not watched a lot of Star Trek. I didn't watch a lot of TV. In fact, once I sort of began my professional career, it was after agreeing to write the book that I made sure I again watched every episode of The Next Generation, mm-hmm. which was quite an effort between midnight and 5 a.m. for about 4 months. And I just had no sense at the time. After the fact, it seems like an obvious thing to have done, but you have to realize at the time, it was not so obvious at all. I was terrified once I agreed to do this. First of all, I was terrified of losing credibility with my colleagues. And secondly, of alienating, 20 million Star Trek fans around the country. And I had to think long and hard of what to do. And again, I feel, while I think popularization is very important, I have one rule, and really only one rule, and that is that you should not knowingly misrepresent the science. Mm-hmm. Because there's so much scientific sort of illiteracy in this country that basically anything I say, people are going to believe. and therefore, I have great license to distort reality. And I think it's especially important when you're writing for a popular audience to try and be very careful about not giving the wrong impression. Now, we all end up doing it, and we'll probably talk a little bit about some of the experiences I've had doing that, too.
Right.
But I tried very hard. And so one of the things, you know, I didn't want to write a book that would say, oh, this won't work, this won't work, this won't work, because that wouldn't have been fun for anyone. At the same time, I didn't want to, I certainly decided that if something was impossible, there was no way that I was going to suggest it was possible. There's, you know, there's great temptation to try and please the public. And so I had to find a balance, and and it worked out after the fact, but it wasn't obvious at the time. And what I decided to do is when something in Star Trek wouldn't work, I would explain that it wouldn't work, but then I'd try and say, but here's something in the real universe that does work. And it would be a way, as I say, to sort of seduce people into thinking about the real world, people who are fascinated by Star Trek. Because, let's face it, when you go to a party and say you're a physicist, people might say, you know, if you're in Cleveland, they might say, how about those Indians? But if you talk about time travel or warp drive or things like that, people are kind of fascinated, and many of them don't even realize it's related to modern science. And of course, the other message of that book was that, and for me, it's a message I try and carry a lot, which is that the real universe is actually far more fascinating than the universe of science fiction.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it was in retrospect, a wonderful way to reach people. And I do believe that's really what popularizing and teaching is all about, which is to reach people where they are, not to expect them to be interested in what you have to say, but to say things in a way that will pique their curiosity.
Yeah, I actually think it's a really great format to pick some question, wherever you derive it from, whether it's a policy issue or, hey, would this thing on Star Trek work? And then just use that as a way of discussing all the relevant science. That's actually much more how science works anyway. The textbook approach of going systematically through A, B, and C, and D, you know, has its purpose, but it's pretty dry and not very compelling.
Well, absolutely. And moreover, there's a lot of pedagogy that suggests that, and this is true for the public as well as students, that really one of the only ways students really learn in terms of internalizing what you teach them is if you confront their own misconceptions.
Mm-hmm.
That's a wonderful way of teaching.
Yep.
And of course, since a lot of people have misconceptions due to science fiction and movies and TV, it's a nice way, I think, also to get people to internalize things.
Yeah.
But, you know, I tell teachers that the biggest mistake they make is assuming that the minute they assume their students are interested in what they have to say, they're lost. You have to convince them to be interested, and you have
right.
to work at it. And so it's nice to find a hook. Star Trek, in this case, was a very successful hook. And I wasn't aware of how deeply ingrained it was, not just in the United States, but around the world. And it's been fascinating to me to discover how all around the world people just would stay home. And I used to think it would be all sort of 16-year-old boys, but it wasn't. It's adults, it's children, it's males and females and doctors and lawyers. And, you know, it's not just, you can't stereotype those people.
Yeah.
And so it's been very satisfying in a way, and, you know, besides being very successful.
Dr. Cross, have you ever gone to a Star Trek convention?
Well, not really. Only one of a sort. I've been, of course, I've lectured many places where there are a lot more Klingons than there are humans, but
yeah.
The 40th anniversary of Star Trek, there was a big event in Seattle, and I did lecture there, and that was my first taste. And frankly, it was a remarkable experience for me, only because I realized that I was a part of the Star Trek lore in a way that I hadn't fully appreciated.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really amazing to see that a lot of people knew me as much as some of the characters on the TV show.
Oh yeah,
I remember. I don't remember when you actually wrote the book, but my brother Bob, who's here, he's on tonight as well. He called me up and said, "Jay, some guy wrote a book about the science of Star Trek," and we talked about the book even before either of us had read it. Just like supposing what the book was going to be about, and that should illustrate to you how geeky we are and how much we love Star Trek. But just hearing the title of it was provocative enough for us to have a conversation about the book.
Yeah, because that's something that I think that science fiction fans in general and Star Trek fans in particular talk about all the time is the science behind, you know, the science fiction. I mean, that's something that we all do. It's actually...
It's true. Well, at a different level, I have to say, when I started to write the book, the web was just kind of beginning then, and I went online to find out what people were talking about and what, you know, what was written, so I would know, you know, what not to repeat if there was anything. And what amazed me is that there were a ton of sites where people would talk about Star Trek physics, but not the physics of Star Trek. Namely, there were a lot of people who clearly, you know, wanted to know the answer but didn't know much physics, who would invent physics that would justify warp drive, or, mm-hmm. you know, they would invent a fictional universe of physics to explain dilithium crystals and all these things. But no one had actually said, you know, how does this relate to the real world? Because, of course, that requires some expertise. And it was, and I never forget, when I wrote that book, one of the first fan letters I got was from someone who said, Dr. Krause, that I've been waiting for 20 years to find a Star Trek book in the science facts section of a bookstore. And I think there are a lot of people who basically ask the question, which is really what I wanted to ask, is could this really happen? And I think a number of my books have dealt with that general theme.
Well, it's very successful. Again, as you say, in retrospect, it seems like a no-brainer. That it would be
Like, why not? I mean, obviously, but you know, the big thing, as I say, I was also confused about my own credibility. I take the fact that I'm an active scientist very seriously, and I didn't want my colleagues to think I've forsaken my standards. And what happened was the opposite in some sense, because I think a lot of physicists looked at it and thought, oh no, what's this? And they look at it and they realize this isn't really a Star Trek book. This is a physics book, and this is a way to get people interested in physics. And the reaction, I have to say, at least in front of my face, from my colleagues over the years, has been very supportive.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, you refer to Carl Sagan occasionally in your writing. Do you find him an inspiration for your popularizing career?
Well, yes. I mean, more after the fact. I mean, I saw Cosmos. I did know Carl Sagan briefly when I was again at Harvard. He used to come visit, but certainly as my own activities in many different ways in some sense have mimicked his, he's also interested in social causes and scientific literacy and attacking nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
As I've tried to do that, I truly appreciate what a profoundly important force he was and how difficult a task it was. So yeah, I've really come to appreciate and admire all of the impact he had and all of the efforts he carried out. And I also understand some of the difficulties. And sometimes, it's true that sometimes I think that people resent popularization. I mean, mm-hmm. among scientists, I think that happens sometimes, and I know he suffered from that.
Yeah, I think in many ways, Sagan popularized popularizing science. You know, and I think he inspired a lot of people, not only in science, but also showing how much of an impact you can have if you actually bother to, you know, try to teach the public what's cool about science.
Yeah, well, I think that's right. And it's unfortunate that we don't have Johnny Carson on anymore.
Yeah.
I often think of that because nowadays, you know, it's really true that he had an impact partly because Johnny Carson was actually interested in science.
Yeah, Johnny Carson was the goods. He was he was good.
Yeah.
You mentioned briefly before, you know, some of the difficulty of dealing with the media and journalists. You know, and I think that this is our perception that this has become increasingly a problem of trying to teach journalists the science that they need in order to properly report on stories. And very recently, you somewhat ran afoul of this in a journalists covering your recent article on astronomers, quote-unquote, shortening the universe's life by observing us. Why don't you tell us about that? What happened with that story?
Well, you know, it's easy. First of all, I should say it's easy to blame the journalists, and I've tried very hard in this instance to not. I think the responsibility for the misimpression was my own. I should know well enough to try and explain things more clearly than I did. I wrote a paper that I was very, I'm still very excited about, that has to do with the quantum mechanics of the universe and the possibility that it might decay and be part of a metaverse of, it's rather a complicated technical subject, in fact, but it may change, in my opinion, the paradigm of what we call the multiverse and something called the eternal inflation. But it involved a very interesting aspect of quantum mechanics. And at the end of the paper, there are some open speculations about future work. And a reporter read the paper, because it's put online, and was fascinated by these speculations of the last two sentences of the paper, which are really not the bulk of the paper. And the first thing I think I should have realized is that it's important. You know, I picked up on that when he got interested in it, but I should have made it clear that's not what the paper is about.
Mm-hmm.
These were open questions. But then when it had to do with the question of whether by the process of measuring the universe that we see today, does that tell us something about our quantum mechanical state that might tell us that we're going to decay more quickly? And the way I put it was, by measuring what we see today, we shorten the expected life of the universe. And what I mean by that is, it's implied for us, and we've ascertained that the universe life may be shorter than we thought it was going to be. But what came out of it was the notion that we were causally affecting it.
Right.
And I was kind of flip, and I was glib about the whole thing. I was having a little fun. And I also don't think I was very clear. And I think the reporter, well, obviously covered what he thought I said. And what happened, of course, was this furor, because the New Scientist not only, well, in this case, got so excited about it that they not only wrote a story about it, they sent a press release. And then another British publication called the Daily Telegraph wrote a little more extreme piece.
Yeah.
Then when I saw this happening, of course I was embarrassed, obviously. But more importantly, I thought it was important to try and both quell the rumors and also try and get the right answers out. So I was kind of pleased with the reaction. I called the Daily Telegraph. I emailed the Daily Telegraph, and we went over their story line by line and changed it so it would be correct. And at least the version that's online now is correct, except for the. Unfortunately, it has the same silly title,
yeah.
Which is "Mankind is Shortening the Life of the Universe." But yeah. If you actually read the details of it, it's correct. And I went on a lot of blogs. I don't go on blogs as a rule, but I tried to respond, especially those blogs that involve scientists, explaining what I, you know, first of all, saying read the paper. The scientific paper I stand by, and I'm very proud of. But actually, the other thing I did do is I changed the last two lines of the paper, which I felt for a scientist when I originally wrote them were somewhat clear, but I felt that they could be subject to misinterpretation, and they were clearly.
Yeah.
So I changed them so that although I think the intent is what I meant, they're much clearer that they don't imply any causal, that we're not causally impacting the future.
Yeah, I mean, you bring up a good point, and I do think that scientists almost need to be thinking when they're writing, even a technical paper, that they are writing to their colleagues and to the public at the same time, because you never know when the press is going to pick up on something.
And they'll pick up on anything that sounds fascinating and exotic. And, you know, I'm writing a piece on that. I'm now writing a believe it or not, column for New Scientist every 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
On both science and science and society. And I'm actually going to writing a piece about that experience and sort of giving some guidelines to scientists and to journalists so that they can try and make sure these kind of things don't happen.
Yeah, and I agree with you that not only do we need to teach journalists how to do better science reporting, we need to teach scientists how to do better dealing with the media and the
problem. Oh, I agree. If you actually talk to science journalists, they actually try and get it right. It's not as if they don't. They try and make it interesting because they're trying to sell papers or magazines. Most of the ones I know don't knowingly fabricate. They just get confused sometimes, and it's important. It's important. It's a two-way street, and it takes two to tango in that regard.
And let me just follow up just about the quantum mechanics question itself. I know we can't go into all the technical details on a show like this, but that is something that we encounter very frequently. You know, obviously as skeptics, we deal a lot with the paranormal and with pseudoscience, and as you say, because the best way to teach people logic and science is to confront their misconceptions. But invoking that notion that by which I think is a misinterpretation of quantum mechanics, that by observing things macroscopically, that the act of observing actually changes them. And, you know, my reading of quantum mechanics is that's not certainly not true on a macroscopic level. And would you agree with that?
Yeah, well, you know, I think yes. I mean, it's very subtle because quantum mechanics is, after all, very weird.
Yeah.
It is true when we look at systems and we observe them, if they're behaving quantum mechanically, what that really means is that there are many states at the same time. And big macroscopic objects don't look like there are many states at the same time. Electrons do. Okay, and when you measure an electron, it may be spinning in many different directions at the same time, yet you measure it and you find it spinning in one direction and you've changed it. So that's clear. Now, a macroscopic system, of course, that it doesn't maintain its quantum coherence. So it basically evolves in one state, in only one state. Now, if you're part of the system, and this is the thing that makes it a little tricky, we're part of the universe, and the universe is a quantum mechanical system. So it is true that although we're not causally changing the universe, every time we look out, we and the universe are in some combined state, which is ultimately quantum mechanical. And the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics basically says, well, that the universe itself could exist in many different states, and we in the universe, you know, when I'm talking to you, anytime I take an action, if you would really say the universe is splitting it into an infinite number of branches of a wave function, and we're all on one branch. Mm-hmm. And every time you make an observation, our branch splits off from all the other branches. And that's a fascinating and weird possibility, but it doesn't affect the universe causally.
Right.
It basically said the universe is doing what it's doing, and we're observing what branch we're on, but we're not changing the behavior of the universe.
Right. I think that's the key.
And, yeah. And another, I mean, it's subtle, and it is subtle.
Yeah, which is why it gets exploited, because it's easy to confuse people about it. And also, I never liked phrasing it in terms of, you know, making the observation causes the quantum mechanical state to go from many things to one thing, because that implies that it's something about the mind of the observer which is changing.
Yeah.
I think the paranormalists get off on. Rather,
right,
it's just that
really, but
it's just that it's interacting
really,
with something else,
right?
By observing that you're
it's interacting, and interactions change a system. And you're right; it's an interaction, and you're right. In fact, one of the things I think I'm saying in this article is that never mention the word quantum mechanics and consciousness in the same sentence.
Right.
Because in a way, the universe observes itself. It's interacting with itself.
Yeah.
So in a way, you don't need human minds to do the observing. It's interacting with itself.
That's the point. It is interacting with itself. And macroscopic systems are interacting with themselves all the time, which means, in a sense, that the different, what would otherwise be many different configurations that are coexisting are not, because the system is driving itself already into one. The different configurations, if you wish, have become decoupled. They're no longer entangled, and so
right.
The system behaves, because it's interacting with itself so often, it basically evolves classically by a specific trajectory and not many trajectories at the same time.
Right.
Decoherence.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Kraus, this has been fascinating. We really appreciate you giving us your time.
Well, thanks a lot. Okay, you take care.
All right, take care.
Thank you.
Good
night.
Good night.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. And then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. And, of course, the listeners can play along as well. Is everyone ready for this week's items?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
No. Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Okay.
No.
Thank you.
No theme, but I think we got some interesting ones this week. Item number one. Contrary to prior belief, new evidence suggests that southwestern American Indians were not introduced to alcohol by Europeans, but were fermenting beer from corn for centuries prior to contact.
I'll go with that one.
Item number two, new research shows that young adults who have a close relationship with their parents are actually more independent. And item number three, new evidence suggests that silicon-based life formed on Earth prior to organic life and may have served as a template for the first organic cells. Jay, go first.
Well, through my powers of deduction, come to the conclusion that, let me see here, new research shows that young adults who have a close relationship with their parents are actually more independent. Contrary to prior belief, Steve, contrary to prior belief, there's new evidence that suggests southwestern American Indians were not introduced to alcohol by Europeans. Everybody knows that's bullshit. That's the fake. Move
okay.
on. Next question.
All right. Rebecca?
I can believe that Native Americans were brewing up beer from corn. That makes sense. I mean, where there's a will, there's a way. And I look at, like, in prison, they make it out of dirty socks and apples. So I think that's possible. And
put a label on it, and you're all set.
Yeah. Young adults having a close relationship with their parents, being more independent, that makes sense to me. Close relationship, they'll probably be more well-adjusted or something. Silicon-based life, what is that, like It's like Pam Anderson, right? I don't even know what that is.
The Horda.
The what?
Never mind.
You just made a nerd joke, didn't you?
Yes.
I made
oh, no, not Bob.
Rebecca, come on.
Isn't that just like the show in a capsule? I made a boob joke and you made a nerd joke. I'm going to go with that one as being the fake. I don't think that silicon-based life formed on Earth prior to organic life.
Okay, Evan?
I agree with Rebecca. I think that's not necessarily the least plausible, but I have a feeling the other two,
you filthy bastard,
are correct.
Well put.
I agree with Rebecca.
Okay,
that's
Bob.
All you need to say.
It's a little tricky. The silicon-based life. That the silicon-based life. That's just too much of a like. Oh my God, give me a break. That's impossible. So I'm going to say that is science. Let's see.
Was he just channeling the nerdy professor from The Simpsons?
Rebecca, aren't you really
inadvertently
I'm always waiting for Bob to just get totally pissed off about something when we hit this segment?
Let's see. Young adults' close relationship with their parents are more independent. I mean, I could kind of see that. It's not raising any red flags, but neither does one raise any red flags.
Do you want to phone a friend, Bob?
No, I already used that. I already used my lifeline. Southwestern American Indians.
Oh, my God.
Sweet Jesus, man. Pick a number.
I'm going to say the young adults' close relationship fiction.
Okay, you're all over the board this week, so let's take them in order. Contrary to prior belief, evidence suggests that Southwestern American Indians were not introduced to alcohol by Europeans, but were fermenting beer from corn for centuries prior to contact. Actually, it's interesting, Bob, you're the only one who commented on that detail of Southwestern American Indians. I had to put that in there because prior belief includes the fact that most Native Americans were fermenting beer from corn and other things before contact with Europeans. It was only the Southwestern American Indians for which we had no evidence that they were using alcohol prior to European contact until this recent study, because this is science. And they do make the point that pretty much every culture everywhere figured out some way to get access to mind-altering drugs of one type or another. And alcohol is
they had
pretty
peyote. What do they need booze for?
Shit.
Yeah, and they had a bunch of desert toads.
Look, you can never have too much, okay?
It's very easy to make beer out of grains.
They need a chaser, Jay.
Wild yeast blows freely, you know, and if you leave bread in water, you'll make beer. It's pretty hard not to stumble across it.
If you don't find out for yourself, the aliens will tell you.
That's right. That's right. They'll come down and make sure that you hear about it. So this was the ancestral Puebloan farmers in New Mexico, Arizona, Utah, and Colorado. They by analyzing their tools and pottery, including examination at the National Nuclear Security Administration Laboratory at Sandia, they discovered evidence that suggests that they were fermenting beer from corn, and that they were probably doing it for centuries prior to contact with Europeans. With this evidence, it seems that all of the Indian tribes were fermenting alcohol. One way or the other. Number two, new research shows that young adults who have a close relationship with their parents are actually more independent. And this one is science. Sorry, Bob. It actually was a psychological conventional wisdom that having a close relationship with your parents was a sign of dependence. But this was the result of some rather extensive research done by Dr. Irit Yanner. So she conducted many, many interviews and completed hundreds of surveys and came to the conclusion that, as she says, the research found that following adolescence, the family connection is an important factor in forming one's identity and living an independent life. It seems that not only can independence and closeness exist together, but they actually flourish together, which is basically what you were saying, Rebecca, that, yeah, they're more stable. They have a better self-image. They feel more confident. They actually are more independent in their relationships with other people and also more financially independent as well. So pretty much every way she chose to look at it, they exhibited greater independence. They were more self-sufficient, more independent in their day-to-day lives, more stable professionally. So it's not a bad thing to have a close relationship with your mom and dad. All of this means that new evidence suggests that silicon-based life formed on Earth prior to organic life and may have served as a template for the first organic cells is fiction.
That sounds good, though.
Although it does sound good. I mean, silicon-based life was a bit of a stretch.
But you bastardized a real story, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, it's been a hypothesis for a long time that there were some templates for the first organic molecules forming and the first cells forming.
Clay and...
The clay hypothesis, as you point out, Bob, that's sometimes referred to as the pizza hypothesis because you have like a pizza, like just organic molecules on the surface, like on top of a flat surface, and that sort of formed the template for them coming together into more complex organic molecules and forming the first building blocks of life. Recently was published a hypothesis of a new possible template. This is... organic molecules forming in the layers between mica. So mica forms these flat, sheets or layers. It's basically a form of mineral. And you can create pockets in between these layers that could have been a place for organic molecules to collect in high concentrations while also existing in separate pockets, which would have allowed for competition, if you will, and that a lot of the complexity could have evolved there prior to actually existing, budding off into cells. So one question is, did the cell membrane, the bilipid layer, form first, these little bubbles of fat, if you will, which is essentially what a cell membrane is, and then the complex biochemistry of life evolve within the cell? Or did the complex biochemistry evolve essentially in a soup? That's where the concept of the primordial soup comes from, just loose in the oceans. Or was there some sequestering, some location where that occurred, and that led to the clay or the pizza model? And now we have another hypothesis, this forming within the layers of mica hypothesis. So. Interesting. It's obviously very difficult to test these hypotheses. Not much survives from the very dawn of biochemistry and life on Earth. And as of yet, we don't have access to any other worlds, where these processes may be happening. So the big challenge is going to be to figure out ways to really test these hypotheses. But no silicon-based life, I'm sad to say.
Oh, well.
So congratulations, Evan and Rebecca.
Thanks.
Once again.
You guys are on a roll.
Yeah, thanks.
Good for you guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure is.
Evan, tell us the answer to last week's puzzle.
An enemy of Scientology and a used car salesman to boot, he developed a strange philosophy of which Zen mastery was the root. Self-taught with no formal degree, he changed his name and ran from home. Gullible masses made him rich, you see. He fled the country with money to Rome. And the answer was Werner Erhard. And do you know who that was?
Nope.
No clue.
Or is? You have no idea who that is? Ever heard of Est?
Oh, Est. Yeah. He's the Est guy, huh?
Erhard Seminar Training?
Est?
It's a self-help cult.
Exactly. This guy took a bunch of wacky ideas from a whole bunch of various philosophy, jumbled it all together into his own soup, and started dishing it out to people in the 70s and 80s. And they bought it by the millions. This guy made a lot of money with his self-help training and so forth. So I didn't know much about it until I looked into it a little more for this puzzle, but didn't realize so many people were in need of self-help, even from the 70s and 80s. I guess it's not that different from today.
If you're willing, there's a lot of money to be made peddling simple answers to life's complex questions. There's no question. And who was our winner this week?
Winner this week is Zam from the message boards. So congratulations, Zam.
Excellent. Congratulations,
Good job, Zam.
Well done.
Way to beat that other guy that kept getting all the answers right.
Yeah.
I can't remember his name.
Yeah,
I don't remember that other guy was.
Johnny something.
Evan, read us this week's puzzle.
Okay, this week's puzzle is as such. A person does the following things. Tugs their ear, puts a pen in their mouth, passes gas, induces vomiting, pulls their tongue, simulates being drowned, presses a brass rod against their cheek. What are they trying to accomplish? So see if you can figure it out. Good luck, everyone.
Curing their OCD.
Very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you, Evan.
No problem.
Jay, please give us a quote to close out the show.
I found this quote. You know, I'm searching online all the time looking for stuff. I found it. I don't think it's 100% certain that Albert Einstein wrote it, or I just found one place where the person wasn't sure, so I'm not 100% sure this is an Albert Einstein quote, but I think it is.
It is attributed to him.
Yes.
As many things are.
No amount of experiments can ever prove me right. A single experiment may at any time prove me wrong. Albert Einstein.
Perhaps.
Thank you, Jay.
My pleasure.
And thank all of you for joining me again.
Thank you, Steve.
Sure.
Always a good time.
Thanks, Doctor, and all.
It was a good time.
Next week, we have Alex Sekiris from Skeptico coming on the show. I mentioned last week when we talked about his recent episode about us that I had invited him on the show. He did not get that invitation until after we recorded, but he agreed to come on for it next week. So we'll be able to do some follow-up at that time.
This should be interesting.
Yep, it should be fun. And we also have coming up the 2007 year-end wrap-up show. So email us your nominations for the funniest bits on the show for the year, or your favorite guests, or whatever superlatives you have. Let us know what you want us to reminisce about at the end of the year. That's coming up in a couple weeks. Thanks again for joining me, and until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and Skeptchick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.